Hello, everybody. I'm Scott.
I am Julie.
And this is A Good Story is Hard to Find podcast,
where two Catholic friends talk about the books and movies they love and the traces of the one reality that lie below the surface.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And this is episode number 104, and we're going to talk about Foundation by Isaac Asimov, the first of the original trilogy.
Oh, yeah, because I've seen it. It confused me when I was getting it from the library and they called it number two in the Foundation series. And I went, no, I think it was the first one. So I just ignored it.
Yeah, that's one of those reading order things. Isaac Asimov, what he wrote, well, Foundation and Empire and Second Foundation are the original trilogy. And what they really are a collection of stories, some of them very long. Although the books are, you know, pretty short by today's standards, I would say. But those all came out in the 50s, and most of the stories were published in magazines. And that was it until in the 80s, the 1980s, he wrote Foundation's Edge. And then from there, he wrote several Foundation novels and several robot novels. And he actually pulled it all together into one thing. So the last couple of books that he wrote in the Foundation series, I think one was called Prelude to Foundation, which is probably what they're calling number one.
Oh, okay.
And then there's Forward the Foundation, I think is what it's called. Mm-hmm. And I think that was the last one that he wrote. And, you know, that was shortly before he passed away. So, yeah, so there's a huge gap, like 30-year gap between when he wrote these and when he continued.
And you told me before that you'd read most of these books.
Uh-huh, yes.
Did he have something new to say in the last ones? I mean, did he pick it up after the 30 years?
I think he went,
I've rethought it, or
no, I would say yes. Although it's been a long, long time since I've read Prelude and Forward the Foundation.
Mm-hmm.
My memory of those are that he was as strong a writer at the very end as he was here.
Mm-hmm.
Forward the Foundation, I recall liking a lot.
Okay.
So I'm not sure what it was that's different in it, but okay. I found it worthwhile.
Got it.
You know, not all the books are excellent, but I thought they were all pretty good. But what's interesting to me is, you know, I saw that you've read some of the robot novels recently.
Yeah.
The Caves of Steel and The Naked Sun?
The Naked Sun.
Again, he wrote those in the 50s. And then a long time after that, he wrote The Robots of Dawn.
And that was the one that I couldn't really get into. I tried it and went, no. And I wasn't sure if it was because I had just really devoured The Caves of Steel and The Naked Sun one right after the other, and I was done with robots for a while, or if it was the book itself. But I can really recommend those other two. They're really good mysteries and, of course, very interesting looks at people living under two very different kinds of circumstances, because one happens on Earth where it's real crowded and there's population concentration. And so they have agoraphobia, and there are all these other things, ways they've adapted to it. And then the other one happens out on one of the space planets where it's the opposite problem. They almost never even see each other in person. It's considered daring because there's so few of them, and they have all this space and lots of robots to take care of them. And so it's kind of interesting watching him tell a great story, because they are good mysteries, but work through these sociological implications of these situations. And that's, I guess, swinging back around to Foundation, that's what he's doing here too.
Mm-hmm.
You know, telling really great stories that you're really absorbed in, but at the same time, he's looking at the rise and fall of civilization.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, and I picked this one mostly because it's one of my all-time favorite books.
And it's a great book.
And I reread it. Oh, good. And I reread it recently, and I just loved it again. You know, I've seen several posts that of people that didn't seem to think that it held up very well, but I thought it held up very well.
Oh, no. Well, yeah. maybe I liked it because it is so classic. I mean, it is science fiction. I mean, yeah. Here are these circumstances and here are these goals and these people have to do this.
Right.
I mean, to me, that's classic.
It is.
And it's the way it's written is great because it doesn't feel dated. I mean, other than some of his assumptions about the future, you know, when he's talking about three-dimension newscasts or something, and we're just like, oh, well, we now would call that something different.
Yeah.
But
not bad for a book written in the 1950s, you know? I like that kind of stuff. You know, when you read books like that and they talk about like 1999 or something, and, you know, I feel ripped off, first of all, but because, you know, we don't have the flying cars. But
I'm still waiting.
Sometimes I think it's probably a good thing. Do we want everybody in flying cars? I don't know. If they were automatic, maybe.
Considering how most people drive, everybody but me,
that's exactly right.
I'm the great driver. But yes, that would make me quite nervous.
Heck yeah.
Then I would want the robot-driven cars. So I would say, is it Google who's doing that?
Come on. Yeah. Let's go Google. Yeah.
Side note, at first I was really against that idea, and then I thought, wait, it would be like having my own little train. All that texting and all that stuff everybody wants to do, you just sit back and let the robot drive like a chauffeur, and you can do your own stuff.
That would be good.
Yeah.
Sounds excellent to me.
Yeah, so come on, man.
Let's get on with it. It's 2015, for heaven's sakes.
Well, and in the writing, it's funny, I never thought of him as being what you call a good writer. I mean, he doesn't have beautiful prose and all that kind of thing, but what he is a really clean writer who can do a lot because, excuse me, if you don't mind, I want to read this first paragraph.
Yeah, please do.
His name was Gail Dornick, and he was just a country boy who had never seen Trantor before. That is, not in real life. He had seen it many times on the Hyper Video, and occasionally in tremendous three-dimensional newscasts covering an imperial coronation or the opening of a galactic council. Even though he had lived all his life on the world of Synax, which circled a star at the edges of the blue drift, he was not cut off from civilization, you see. At that time, no place in the galaxy was. And that does so much to... We know who he is. We know he's like Luke Skywalker. He's a farm boy. We know that his world, a little bit about it. I love that Hyper Video, so futuristic sounding. But he tells you everything you need to know about that world right there. I mean, he goes on and says there are 25 million inhabited planets, blah, blah, blah. But right there, you have the whole sense of everything you need to know to get you going. I thought that was really skillfully done.
Yeah, that is skillfully done. In writing classes, he's held up often as a transparent writer, someone who gets completely out of the way. And, you know, you don't notice the narration when you read Asimov.
Maybe that's what it was. And that's why that first paragraph struck me, because I hadn't read it in so long and I didn't remember most of it. I remembered a few of the big things, you know,
the
overall point of the story. But I was so surprised at just how the story just flew. It made me think in a way, and you've read a lot more Mike Resnick than I have, but he made me think of Mike Resnick.
No, does he write? Yeah. I mean, yeah, possibly. Yeah, I'm just thinking about like Kieran Yaga. I don't know.
Well, I didn't feel a narrator there.
Yeah, it's probably true. Yeah.
And does a lot with putting short stories together or writing chapters like that. I don't know.
Yeah. Anyway. No, that's not a bad comparison at all. You know, and Resnick is, you know, still writing old-time science fiction, which I love.
Me too. Yeah. And he's incredibly prolific, although he doesn't write all the nonfiction that Asimov must have been writing with both hands or typing with both hands. I don't know how he did it.
Yeah. I don't know how he did it either, but it's hundreds of books. I don't know who's got the record for most books written, but I remember in the library as a kid coming across a book called Opus 200, which was written by Isaac Asimov, and I opened it, and what it was excerpts from the books that Asimov wrote, 101 to 200.
Wow.
And there was an Opus 100, and I think there was an Opus 300, if I'm not mistaken.
Oh my gosh.
So it was just like a little short story collection almost, but just excerpts.
Oh, how interesting.
Here's a book with my other 100 books in it.
Like, I helped on the excerpts so I could keep it readable. Well, yeah. Because at one point I looked through, I didn't actually read the whole thing, but he wrote a book about the Old Testament, a book about the New Testament. And even though he was an atheist, he dedicated them to a friend of his who had faith. And it was just looking at the facts of what was going on at the time of the book.
Asimov's Guide to the Bible.
And yeah, that's it.
Asimov's, he has a Shakespeare one too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And the great thing was, I have to say, is he says right up front, you know, he's not a believer, but you didn't get the feeling he wasn't going around trashing the religion of it.
Hmm. That's nice.
Which is how you could, how he could dedicate it to his friend of faith. You know, he was just interested in, oh, what was going on at this time? What king was this? What, you know, was the civilization like? That kind of thing.
That's great. Yeah, well, I think I may look for that then.
Yeah. No,
I never have read that one. Yeah. That's great. Okay, so...
We're way off Foundation. Sorry.
No. So Foundation itself, what the book is generally about is the main character, you could say, is Harry Seldon. But it is a collection of five stories, and Harry Seldon is not the main character in each one, although he plays a role in each one. So Harry Seldon is a person who has, using something called psychohistory, which is, you know, a branch of mathematics, psychology and mathematics put together, he has figured out a way to predict the actions of a large group of people. So it's worthless to predict the actions of a single person, but as a community, you can predict things like trends and things. I think is that a fairly complete description? So he has calculated that the empire, this galactic empire, is about to fall, and it's not preventable. And he started to say this, and of course the people in charge don't like him saying this, because what he's basically saying is, you guys are incompetent and can't possibly stop this horrible thing from happening. And he further predicts that there's going to be a long dark ages.
30,000 years.
Yeah, 30,000 years. So the plan, or his plan, is we can shorten that into 1,000 years if we gather all the knowledge of humanity and put it somewhere safe. So... him saying this stuff is basically looked at as rabble rousing by the government. And in the first story, the psycho historians, that's where this fellow Gal Dornick comes from, you know, that paragraph that you read. He goes to Trantor, which is a planet that is one giant city. And, you know, if you look at the influence Foundation has had on other pieces of science fiction, that's one of the things in Star Wars, is a planet that's all one big city.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's called Coruscant in there.
Okay.
But anyway, so Trantor is this, you know, it's the seat of government in this galactic empire. And it's one giant city. And, you know, of course, you know, Gal Dornick is seeing it for the first time, is just amazed by it. And anyway, he is there to... He has been recruited by Harry Seldon to work on this project, on this psychohistory project, and is immediately swept into basically a court case where Harry Seldon...
He's arrested for treason.
Yeah, he's arrested for treason. So, you know, Harry Seldon is defending himself quite cynically, I would say.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's one of the joys of the book. You know, there's so much dialogue. There's not a heck of a lot of action. But it's dialogue, and you know, it really does move, like you said, at a really quick clip, and there is a lot of drama there, even though there's not, like, you know, an immediate, you know, gun in your face type of things. You know,
right.
They're dealing with huge things, in conversation.
So, and so what happens is they get exiled to a planet where they can just work on their encyclopedia by themselves if they want.
Right. The Terminus. Terminus is what they call this planet. And then the encyclopedia you mentioned is this repository of knowledge. That's what they're going to do. They're going to bring a bunch of people to this distant planet on the edge of the Empire. And they're just going to collect all of the knowledge that they can into an encyclopedia. And therefore, when the Empire does fall, they will be ready to distribute that information in quick order, and thus shorten the Dark Ages.
Mm-hmm.
And when I thought about that on this last read that I did, I thought, you know, about monks and the Dark Ages in real history, and them copying their manuscripts and keeping the knowledge of humanity during the Dark Ages. There's a book called The Catholic Church. Let's see, it's by Thomas Cahill, How the Catholic Church Saved Civilization.
Oh, okay.
And it sort of describes what a lot of monasteries were doing during that time. And they certainly didn't, I don't think they realized what they were doing. It's not like, we have to do this in order to shorten our Dark Ages. It's, I'm not saying that, but the monasteries in the Catholic Church were a lot of the reason that a lot of things got saved.
Yeah, they were integral.
Mm-hmm.
To bringing everything back. Well, and the thing is, because people will people like to look back at history and you put your own interpretation on it, right?
Yeah,
and
yeah.
They'll, to me, looking at what those monks actually did kind of sets some of those interpretations on their ears, because they were saving all kinds of information, not just the theology. Hmm. They saw all information as truth. And truth was important because truth gives you a better view of God, who is truth himself. So they were saving everything they could, as well as the reason they were distributed the way they were throughout the countryside and everything was they were there to help the people. They were, giving medical care and offering better farming techniques and, of course, spreading the gospel, because that's the best thing they could do. Mm-hmm. But along with that, you help people.
Yeah.
So,
I think it's neat.
When I looked at this, I was looking at the chapter names, the psychohistorians, the encyclopedists, which is the basic, like the monks, the mayors, the traders, the merchant princes. And now what it's making me think of is, did you ever play that video game called Civilization?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, and it's that where you just... It looks like Asimov just said, what is the path of civilization? How did civilization spread? And, of course, you see this pattern in different civilizations, like, I guess the Phoenicians and the mm-hmm. Egyptians and the whoever. But I just looked at it and went, oh, how interesting to take this to somebody who's got this outside knowledge and is mm-hmm. going to help. But everybody who's living in this book just has to deal with what's going on in the book.
Wow, that's really cool. I just love that. I'm looking at that. The psychohistorians, the encyclopedists, the mayors, the traders, the merchant princes. I remember Joseph Campbell a long time ago. I was watching a show that he was in, and he was saying, if you want to know what's most important to a society, see what their biggest buildings are for.
Oh.
And he said Salt Lake City is a wonderful example. Because for the longest time in Salt Lake City, the Mormon temple was the biggest building in town.
Mm-hmm.
And now it's not. Now you've got banks and things, just like any other normal city.
Mm-hmm.
I thought, so I'm looking at this and it reminds me of the same thing. It's like the encyclopedists, we're looking at knowledge. And then the mayors, we're looking at politics. Mm-hmm. And then the traders and merchant princes, well, now we're looking at money. Yeah.
Yeah, trade and
right,
money.
Exactly.
Well, and the way each of these stories is told, starting with Harry Seldon, but especially after him, is to me, I don't know if it's ever described this way, but to me, this read like a series of trickster tales. You've got your Brer Rabbit caught in with the tar baby. And I mean, usually not through their own fault. Usually... Brer Rabbit was just being sassy, but you're stuck, and you have to get out of this situation or it's going to be a dire consequence. And they always manage to talk or trick their way out of it by being cleverer.
No, I love that. That's really cool.
And that's what makes the story really, so engaging.
That's an excellent description. Yeah.
Yeah.
Because, yeah, the pinch that these folks are usually in are, well, it's survival. It's but you have this other thing. You have Harry Seldon as if his ghost is overseeing everything. You know, it's almost a religious type of a thing where, you know, people are saying, well, you know, we've got to trust the plan. You know, Harry Seldon set us on this plan, and we've got to trust this plan. And then you've got, what's the main character's name? I can't remember.
Hardin,
yeah, Salvor Hardin, who is the mayor of Foundation in the second story. But he doesn't have any power in the second story. He is, you know, right. the power is held by this committee of encyclopedists who have their own focus, you know, but they're being threatened by worlds around them as this empire falls. And he's like, we need to do something. And they're like, well, we just got to trust the plan. Everything's going to be fine. We're just going to trust this plan and then go ahead and continue with what we were doing. And he's like, no, we need to do something. So, you know, again, you know, that does have a kind of a religious parallel there.
Well, and it's funny because most of them don't even listen to him. I mean, they're just like, well, no, our job is to work on the encyclopedia. We don't even understand what you're talking about. We're just working on that. You just do whatever. But there's one person on that committee of encyclopedists who says, well, Harry Seldon knew everything would be like this. His plan, this is probably, did they call it a Harry Seldon crisis at that time? I can't remember.
I don't think so. I think at the end of this story, story after that, now.
But
you know,
they knew that he would show up, like there was a place called the Vault.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And they knew that if there was a crisis or something, they should go to the Vault and like he'd have a message for them or something like that. And so the one person says, no, it's fine. He's got a plan. So there's this one true believer. And then there's Hardin who's like, screw that. I have to do something, man. And so what you see is the shift of power because an individual is going to save everybody because somebody's got to step up. And the thing that's kind of interesting to me is we're getting way into spoiler territory now.
Oh yeah, we're well. This book was written in 1951, so
I figure if you're listening at this point,
I think we can
read it.
We can handle it. You bet. I love it.
Can you handle the truth?
Can you handle the truth?
Anyway, what Harry Seldon says at that point, or basically a hologram of him shows up, and he says, well, if my predictions are right, and they are, it's been 50 years, and you've made it through the first, you know, crisis. And by the way, the whole encyclopedia thing was a hoax. And there's like, what? Hardin's going, knew it. Knew that wasn't so important.
Oh,
but
my gosh.
He says something that I thought was really interesting. He says, from now on and into the centuries, the path you must take is inevitable. Oh, wait, sorry. I should have read the sentence before. To that end, we have placed you on such a planet and at such a time that in 50 years you are maneuvered to the point where you no longer have freedom of action. From now on and into the centuries, the path you must take is inevitable. You will be faced with a series of crises as you are now faced with the first. And in each case, your freedom of action will become similarly circumscribed so that you will be forced along one and only one path. And I looked at that and I went, wait a minute, this sounds familiar. because what it made me think of was as a Christian, we think of, I have a quote here somewhere and I can't see if I have it marked, but basically that's like God's plan. You know, he's outside of history. And just like Hardin in there, he's like, I've got to find a way out of this crisis. Whereas Harry Seldon on the outside, looking at the big picture, says, oh yeah, this crisis will happen, this will happen, but you're always going to be forced into one way of acting. through all these other circumstances and all these choices everybody makes. And that's not exactly how we think of God, because God is outside of time, and it's weird because he sees the future happening at the same time as the now is happening for us. He's not linear. So he sees each of us individually. But I did, I am reading this book called The Lord by Romano Guardini. It's a book that really was influential to Pope Benedict when he was growing up, or a young priest, I guess. And he says something. He says, God's word is a command that brings with it the possibility of obeying. It creates its own acceptable time. The hour rejected not only vanishes, but trails a wake of disaster. And so the idea is, if you don't do this, bad things are going to happen. You don't have to do it. It's a choice. And because then later he's talking about his idea of, as Jesus was going through his life, if the Pharisees and everybody had accepted what he was saying and kind of absorbed it and changed their ways, he didn't have to have that sacrifice on the cross necessarily. He could have transformed it into heaven on earth right then if everybody had accepted him. And I went, that's interesting. And so then he says,
yeah, I hadn't heard that Jesus, before.
I know, me either, but Jesus' position in the world being what it is, and his relations to people developing as they do, the possibility of his destruction gradually swells to what is practically a necessity. It is that must, which he himself often implies.
Huh.
So it's in that same way he's echoing what Isaac Asimov is saying about history. Is you're offered all these choices, and it's all these choices that you make that lead you to one big thing that changes everything. It's just that Asimov, you feel like, it's funny, he's got this tension in his story between the bigger idea of how these crises work, and then you're seeing all the people who have to live inside of it.
Right.
Like we do.
Right.
Inside of history.
That's excellent. I just love that. I'm sitting here thinking about it, but I mean, of course you're right, and it's a neat way to look at this. But yeah, that had not occurred to me. And that stuff you're reading, you say that's The Lord by Guardini?
Mm-hmm. By Romano Guardini. And what he's done basically is look at the four Gospels as a whole.
Mm-hmm.
So he's not picking them out, but he'll just go Jesus's childhood, or, you know, now his baptism. And so he's looking at what all the Gospels will say about the baptism, and then he's kind of commenting on it. And man, it's great because the chapters are all pretty short. They're just 4 or 5 pages. So you can read one and then think about it. And the stuff that's in him, he's always comes back to what we would call Orthodox Catholicism, or you know, the traditional line. But he'll go outside of it and think about it and go, well, maybe Jesus didn't have to be on the cross. At what point did he realize that had to happen? He's fully human as well as fully God. So where does he see this constriction narrowing? But at the same time as he's thinking about all that, he's pointing out, he never wavered. He, whatever the Father's will was, that love was there that said, I trust you. This is what has to happen. And I love these people. I love everyone. This is what has to happen. I'm marching, not marching forward. I'm flinging myself into it. Wow. Whatever we have to do. And so it's a really great book. I'm so glad that I came across it for Lent.
Oh, that's neat. Yeah, it's definitely going on my list. Yeah, that's certainly ideas that I haven't been presented with. It's great.
Yeah, and it just kind of opens up. Well, and it's kind of like Asimov's book in a definitely secular sense, opens up these ideas of destiny and history versus individuals in it.
Yeah, so that's interesting as well. Now, Asimov has said that the Roman Empire was the model for what he wrote here, just as an overall arching inspiration for it.
They're kind of like the encapsulation of civilization that way,
right? And he is saying something about human nature as well, by saying that this mass of people gets into a spot where they have no choice. They've been maneuvered into a place where they have no choice. You know, one thing is, you know, they're maneuverable, right? Mm-hmm. So, mm-hmm. You know, it does say that, you know, human nature is kind of a quantifiable thing by the existence of psychohistory in the first place,
mm-hmm.
Which also strikes me as an interesting statement. Kind of in a religious way as well. It's almost like, you know, human nature is what it is. And, you know, we can often ourselves, you know, predict how a group will react to a certain thing, you know, and it's never, you're never, when you make a statement like that, a blanket statement, you're not saying anything about an individual. You're saying, mm-hmm. Something about a group. And, you know, usually you're right on a group is going to react a certain way. But you can't, like I said, you can't say anything about a person in the group.
Yeah. And at what point, I guess for me, what this raised also is at what point does a person in the group make a difference so that it changes the dynamic of where that group is headed? Because I just finished reading The Churchill Factor by Boris Johnson.
Yeah.
Really great book, fairly mm-hmm. short, but a wonderful way to look at Churchill's life. And he is not apologizing for being an apologist, basically defending Churchill against a lot of the criticisms that are leveled against him these days, which I wasn't aware of many of them. Also thinking of Churchill as a great man. But one of the things he's championing is this idea of history, that history is made by people. That a great person, whether for good or ill, like Hitler, Stalin, you know, going further back, there's all kinds of people, make a difference. And then you've got the other kind of looking at history, which is that book. It's, what is it? Guns, Germs,
Steel. Yeah, Guns, Germs, and Steel by Jared Diamond.
Yeah, which is that idea that history is formed by... What is it?
Environment.
Geographic, yeah, and environmental, and
right.
other pressures like that that are from outside. And so kind of we're like, I don't know, it kind of takes the humanity out of it. I think it's probably a combination of both things.
Yeah, but I would think so too.
I feel mm-hmm. like the great man is, I feel like that's what's right.
Uh-huh.
Because I feel like if you don't have some of those people, it changes the course of history. Like, and that's kind of what he's talking about in this book. And I think it's ironic that the whole point of the book is to talk about Harry Seldon's predictions. And every so often they'll go, it's a Seldon crisis. And sure enough, he's popped up and gone, you made it through the second one. Huzzah, guys. It's just going to get worse, by the way. Bye.
Yeah.
They're like, this is not helpful at all.
Right. And in this book, before we move on, he's really got both kind of views of history. So I think that, you know, he agrees that there's elements of both here, because mm-hmm. Terminus is a world that doesn't have hardly any resources on it.
Yeah.
And he's put the people on it. So they do have an environmental restriction in what's possible for them. They need other worlds. They can't be totally isolated.
Mm-hmm. That's clever too.
Yeah, it was really clever. And then, I guess... Well, what I'm moving into the second book here,
yeah.
but your idea of a great man influencing history, there's that happens in number two.
Well, that happens in all of them, really.
It does, but in a great extent in number two.
Yeah, mm-hmm. yeah.
Right.
Well, and then because by the end they get to the point where the great man, or the mover of the story, essentially, is saying, Harry Seldon may be out there. His theory's out there. That's fine. I don't care. Mm-hmm. That's up to them. I'm here to do my thing. I solved this. Moving on. And so he essentially doesn't believe or care about any of the future. That's not his problem.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is really how most of those great people are, I think, unless they're just like, everybody needs to remember me.
Right. Yeah, that's true. One other aspect that kind of touches on religion that I want to make sure we talk about is in some of these stories, the foundation on Terminus has knowledge of atomic power. And one of the things that happens when the Empire starts to fail is that the worlds lose the ability to have atomic power because their support network is gone. And the people who really know how to do it, you know, they don't exist on every world. Mm-hmm. So, but Terminus, Foundation, they still know how to do it. And as the years go by, this becomes almost magical. And that's their resource. That's their main resource is this knowledge, right? Right? So to leverage that, what they do is they create a religion. They make it a religious thing. They say these are holy artifacts and they work because of our priests and things like that. And thus, they have a way to wield power over these other groups. So it's almost as if they are skipping past the political apparatus of these other worlds and going right at the people. Because mm-hmm. the people believe in this religion. And there's some fear there as well that's used for political reasons.
Yeah, and it was kind of funny to me when I was thinking about it because you and I had previously kind of mentioned to each other his story Nightfall.
Yes. Uh-huh.
In thinking about how he talks about science and religion and everything, mm-hmm. which super famous story, highly recommended. I love it so much. Mm-hmm. And I think this story echoes a lot of what I saw there when I recently listened to it, which was he doesn't hold up any group as better than another group to me. I mean, he looks at here's the herd of scientists who are blindly doing what they do. Here's the herd of religious people. And every so often somebody will pop up from one of these groups who is more honest or a better thinker.
Mm-hmm.
Or whatever, and they, again, change how things are done. But everybody else is easily manipulated, even the scientists.
Right. Yeah, and we mentioned that Asimov is an atheist, and probably a writer he was closest to was Arthur C. Clarke, who yeah. also was an atheist. They were very different writers, though. But
he
Asimov
felt like a different kind of atheist, too, to me, Clarke. He felt like uh-huh. Angrier atheist.
An angry atheist, yeah. He's maybe a precursor to a lot of the British atheists we have now.
Dawkins
uh-huh. and Stephen Fry and,
right.
and Ricky Gervais. You know, so the but Asimov in in Nightfall, a quick summary of Nightfall is that there's a planet that, due to this astronomical arrangement, has multiple suns, and because of the way that it's arranged, night falls on this planet very rarely. I can't remember how rarely.
Like every 500 years,
yeah,
or
something
like
that.
That.
So it becomes mythical, and there's a lot of legend and a lot of worrying, and then there's some scientists who are like, you know, this is going to happen, and people
yeah,
that don't believe them.
The eclipse is happening.
Yeah, right. So anyway, you know, people freak out in this story, and my it's been a long time since I've read it, so you're going to have to tell me. But my impression is that the irrational people in that story were the religious folks. But you're saying you didn't feel that way.
Well, no, it was kind of interesting because in the story, the religious people had their texts that the scientific people knew about because they spent some time poo-pooing them and going, well, they say this. I mean, and so they showed the scientists have very carefully, based on what they know, they've thought out, you know, we got to the theory of gravity. It took us like 400 years to come up with it and all this because they have the three suns. It's throwing everything off from what we'd known. At one point, the scientists are talking about, well, let's just get crazy. Let's say there's a planet with one star. What? They could have gotten to gravity earlier. They could have figured these things out sooner. They would have known this and this and this. And so they're feeling like they're pretty crazy when they're going, you know what? The galaxy might have as many as 12 suns in it. I don't want to get nuts on you guys.
Mm-hmm.
And they're all going, whoa, really? So they've been practicing and getting ready for it. And they've been like shutting themselves in dark rooms and dealing with their claustrophobia because they've never had the dark, full dark ever. And But what you realize as, you know, the outsider reading this is a lot of what they're poo-pooing in the religious text is actually what has been observed during these eclipses. But the scientists are just ignoring it all because none of it makes sense and it's just religious babble. And at the same time, they're very carefully applying their facts to everything. Well, their known facts don't take in the fact that they are in like the heart of a very, no, inhabited is the wrong word, but there's tons of stars where they are. So when the lights go out, they're not just 12 little suns somewhere that they can see as little star pricks in the sky. They're in the middle of all these other stars, and they realize they're not alone and they can't handle it. And so what you see, I think what you're supposed to see is science is good, maybe, but what I felt, and so maybe this is really what you're supposed to feel, is, you know, both sides were wrong. Both sides had a lot that they should have been open to, and they weren't. Everybody had their dogmatic way of looking at everything. Because at the end of the book, they're also burning, or the story, they're also burning anything to get light. Which is why there were not many documents except religious ones left, because when that happens, that everybody's burning anything that's wood or flammable, because they can't take the dark.
Yeah, I like it. I've got to reread that story. Yeah, that didn't unfold exactly like I remember it, so I'm going to
Not me either at all. And, you know, if I've got the wrong take on it, that's just how it hit me. But then coming back and thinking about Foundation, I was like, well, this is just a different examination of the same sort of thing. I mean, science comes off better in this book in terms of the psychohistorians, but how many times do we see the dogmatic scientists, the dogmatic religious people? And like I said, you know, here and there, somebody steps up that changes things. And really, it's funny because if the story is all about the foundation and what we've put into place to handle everything and these big trends, from the very beginning, Harry Seldon is a person who changes things by having this theory that can shorten things.
Right.
It's just kind of it's ironic.
And, I assume he planned it that way. Yeah, the great man theory of history.
Yeah, I assume he planned it that way because he's not, you know, he doesn't strike me as somebody who wrote things by accident. And I guess the other books look at that too. I read them so long ago. Mm-hmm. I guess I need to read the other ones.
Yeah, I plan on working my way through all of them. But you know how those plans go.
Hey, 10, 15 years from now is as good as any time.
I'm still working on a Fall of Hyperion. I'm going to finish that. but yeah, but Clark as well, you know, you said he's different. You know, the big story for me that he wrote when I was a kid was The Star. And The Star had a Jesuit scientist who was looking at the remnants of a civilization in space. And because of the timing of it, et cetera, I mean, he had kind of a crisis of faith. And, you know, now that we talked about Nightfall in depth, I also remember a story that Clark wrote called The 9 Billion Names of God, in which...
it's a computer, right?
Yeah, this computer, well, it was a monastery who was calculating all the possible names of God, and they were printing them out. And once they had the last one printed, then something happened.
I forgot about that.
Yeah, so that. But but Clark seemed to always, or often, he said he was an atheist, but then he was famous for these godlike aliens. It's like, you know, God doesn't exist, but this godlike alien might exist. You know, like in 2001, 2010, I mean, there's this transcendent, you know, this alien race or races we don't even know are so far beyond us that to us they're God. And, you know, they don't even need ships to fly around. They're, you know, and I'm trying to think of some other, like Childhood's End, you know, so, a race comes to the earth to uplift us in a way or to take us to the next stage of evolution.
So he's not content with mankind, then he's got to have some kind of godlike creature anyway in the story?
That's, yeah. And it happens often in Clark's stuff.
Well, I know that I remember The Star because, you know, that and Nightfall, I think, are the two science fiction stories that anybody who's ever tried the field has read them. And I read based on Nightfall, then I listened to The Star, much shorter and definitely, oh my gosh, so much more pointed. You know, science isn't taking anything in the chops. This guy's a Jesuit, and the way the story is told is really, I felt, I hadn't read it since way before I became a Christian. So as a Catholic reading it, I'm like, wow, he is not stupid. He's advancing every known argument that people still use today in all these kind of arguments from the Jesuit point of view. And so you get to the denouement of the story, and I was both in awe of his brilliance as a storyteller, and then I was pissed off because I felt like he set up a straw man in the Jesuit priest, having him be the person who loses his faith over this thing. And not having anything but facts to fall back on, no faith, just the arguments. But I guess that's how those stories are told if you don't have faith yourself.
Right, right.
You know, like, oh, I can only blindly believe. Well, because there's no God in this. And the thing that's funny to me about The Star is everybody remembers it. And I remember when I read it, I thought it was a great story when I read it. I do remember thinking, wow, he's so mean. Okay.
Yeah, I don't remember the meanness. Maybe I need to look at that story again. But I've read it a few times.
Hit me when I first read it. I went, wow, he's got something to say. Okay.
Yeah, and then, I do recall. I'm sorry. Yeah. I'm interrupting you.
No, go ahead.
I just remember, you know, I read it at a formative time. Definitely. I was probably 13 or something like that. And it did enhance my feeling of atheism that I had at the time. But I also recall learning, oh, they're Jesuits. I didn't really know. And Jesuits are scientists. How wonderful is that? You know, that was something that it gave me. But I don't know. It's a fake situation, right? Yeah. Like you said, it's a straw man situation. It's almost like, you know, when you read it and you're done, if you lose your faith because of this story, you're like, you're losing your faith over something that's completely not even true. It's sort of saying that, you know, if this had happened, how horrible would that be?
Well, maybe pretty horrible. And I have to give Clark credit, though, because once I got done being mad at that, then I was moved back to awe of his brilliance again, because I realized what he was doing is everybody who that story touches and likes to use it for an example. And I've run into people who go, well, I like that story. They're not arguing about that situation. Mm-hmm. What he did there was set up a look at the complaint of suffering and evil in the world. And how can a good God exist if there's suffering and evil? And that's the hardest question for anybody to deal with, I think.
Yeah. But in addition, I think maybe the unfair thing is that the suffering, I mean, we're bouncing around so I apologize to anybody who hasn't read it, but it's so short and, you know, we don't want to reveal it because it removes the power of the story, but the, God caused the suffering and used it to his cold advantage.
Right. In the story.
And that's what seems unfair.
Yes, because that was the thing that made me mad. Let me clarify, was because there were other examples of similar events, astronomical events happening that are cited earlier. Well, nobody's getting mad about that.
Yeah, yeah.
They're just getting mad when they think God's using it to his own advantage for a special group of people.
Right.
And so it's interesting, which I may have just given away everything, but the thing that I did like about it is the reason that story resonates is it encapsulates the complaint and the struggle that everybody coming up against God has, which is, there's all kinds of awful things that happen that hurt people. Why would you let this happen? And that's the mystery of the cross. That's and I only go into that because it's Holy Week right now as we record this. Tomorrow's Good Friday. So this is very much present on my mind, and I've been reading about it and thinking about it. And it's, you know, for a Christian, the reason Christ went to the cross for our redemption was because he loved us. He, as fully God and fully man, but fully God, he went and took that for us. He was like, there's nothing that can happen to you that I haven't had it happen first. I'm here with you. I love you. And his resurrection is God's, as I read recently somewhere, is God's proof of that continuing love. He trusted his love, like I said, was for God. I love you so much. I trust your plan. And for God the Father, sorry. Mm-hmm. And for us, anything is worth it for you guys.
Amen.
For each of you.
Right.
And so that's the, but the mystery of the cross is he didn't say, and I'm going to do away with all suffering. He went through the suffering himself. So that's why it's a mystery. We don't understand it, but we can see that we're not alone in it, which is not going to convince anybody who doesn't believe. And I get that. And I'm not saying that for that reason. It's just kind of coming out.
Yeah. Yeah.
Sorry.
No, no need to apologize for that. My goodness. No, it's wonderful. And, yeah. So, foundation. I'm just like, where do we go from here? But
yeah,
my goodness.
The guy who's more neutral on the whole thing.
Right. But yeah, I like that, you know, Asimov, you know, he does seem like a very friendly guy. I think he would have been fun to know.
Yeah, he doesn't seem to, I don't know, yeah, have a bone to pick. I mean, he himself may not agree with all this stuff, but he's like, well, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
You can believe, but here are the problems everybody's got because we're human beings. And I think for a story, for a book that is really a series of trickster tales, it looks at human nature so well.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And that's what makes it fun to read.
That is. I think so, too. Yeah, I was very pleased to on the rereading it to find that I loved it still.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so I do plan on moving on and reading them all eventually, hopefully soon.
Yeah.
But yeah, another thing that I wanted to mention, let's see, in 1966 they had a Hugo vote for best all-time series, and Foundation won.
Uh-huh.
And at that time it was a trilogy. But the books that it was up against were the Barsoom series by Edgar Rice Burroughs,
mm-hmm.
the Future History series by Heinlein, mm-hmm. and the Lensman series by Smith.
Oh, yeah.
And the kicker, The Lord of the Rings by Tolkien.
Oh, crazy. What?
So Foundation is number two, I guess.
I just need a moment.
You've just lost all faith in the Hugo Awards.
Oh, that had been done already. But it obviously goes deep.
Well, it started back in 66. That's funny.
I can give him the fact that, was it science fiction trilogy or whatever? Science fiction series?
Yeah, it said best all-time series.
Fantasy and not science fiction. And so,
yeah. What would you call the Lensman series? Science fiction or fantasy?
I read part of the first
call that
one.
Science fiction, probably.
Have you read them?
Well, long time ago, E.E. Doc Smith.
Yeah,
it seems to me I read the first
space
one.
Space opera.
Space opera. And then the Future History series. I think that's just a collection of stories and things.
Okay, but Heinlein's more likely to be science fiction.
Right,
than.
Right.
Well, I will say this though. I just finished reading Tolkien's letters. And there's one point where he's writing to someone going, thank you for sending me this interview that you're going to publish. I'd like to correct a number of things that you got wrong. I never said this. I didn't say that. And he goes, at one point, they say he doesn't have time to read. And he goes, well, I actually do have time to read. There's not a lot that I enjoy reading. But he goes, I really enjoy, and it was, I think, R.R. Eddington's stories. He goes, and I love, I really like the science fiction of Isaac Asimov.
Oh, how about that?
Isn't that great?
Oh, that makes me happy. That's
Isn't
cool.
Isn't that great? That and that was great. Like maybe 1969 or something. Uh-huh. I know. I was
he probably read Foundation. Yeah, that's neat.
Yeah.
That's cool.
Yeah.
I like it.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, cool.
And he doesn't seem like he would have cared about winning or losing the Hugos.
I'm sure not. I'm sure not. That's too funny. Oh, cool. Well, great. I'm glad you enjoyed it. This was an interesting conversation. It took turns that I did not expect.
Wow. Yes.
But neat. Either. I loved it. That's great.
Yeah. It was, isn't that funny how that works out?
It is funny. But, highly recommended. Mm-hmm. Yep, 1950s science fiction. All right, so let's see. Up next, we've got Shall We Dance?
Oh, yes.
A movie from Japan. And I found that on Netflix. It's streaming on Netflix. So if anybody is looking for that, it's there. And then Valley of Bones by Michael Gruber.
Yes, mystery and religion and murder in Miami.
In Miami, no less.
Yeah.
All right.
It's all exotic in every way it can be.
That's great. That's great. So I need
feel
to get
like
a movie.
Miami's a different country. I'm not sure why I feel that way. I just do.
Well, I do too.
And you've been there recently.
I've been there recently, yeah. That's where, that's where I keep going, off into the woods. Yeah, and then after that, I need to get a movie picked, and I've got the book picked. So we'll announce that in the next episode.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Excellent. Well, thank you very, very much. This was fun.
Yeah, no, thank you. I wouldn't have reread it, and it was so enjoyable.
Oh, good. I'm glad.
Yeah.
All right. Well, see you soon, everybody.
Sooner than usual.
Sooner than usual. Yes.
Yes. Well, have a great week then.
Yes, you too. And happy Easter.
Oh, happy Easter, everyone.
Yeah.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.